Chapter 11. Find Meaning in Discomfort. A 41-year-old man stood at the lectern. He had dark hair pulled back over his head. His round glasses and attire hinted at his importance and credentials, an MD who was also pursuing a PhD. It was a Saturday evening, 5 p.m. to be exact, in a lecture hall at an adult education college. For the next 5 Saturdays, the professor would deliver a series of hour-long lectures to whoever attended. The course description made clear the seriousness of the talks. Suicide Forced Annihilation, The World of the Mentally Ill, Sexual Education, along with one final lecture that became known as the Experimentum Crucis, a Latin phrase borrowed from Isaac Newton's breakthrough discoveries and used to describe an experiment that puts the nail in the coffin in one scientific theory and elevates the new theory to superiority. The professor began the first lecture. To speak about the meaning and value of life may seem more necessary today than ever. The question is only whether and how this is possible. While the topics of the lecture may have seemed to indicate to the listeners that they were sitting in an abnormal psychology class, the topics were a means to an end. Over 5 Saturdays, the professor outlined his theory on the keys to having a meaningful life. He railed against conventional wisdom, declaring that joy could not be pursued, and that happiness should not, must not, and can never be a goal, but only an outcome. Such pursuits did not bring meaning to our life. They did not fill our soul. Instead, if we wanted to be fulfilled, there were 3 ways to achieve this. First, the act of doing. Creating, whether it be in an artistic pursuit or a labor of love, brought meaning to one's life. The second was in experiencing. Nature, love, art, or anything that might create the sensation of awe and expand one's perspective of the world. You can imagine an audience sitting in a lecture hall being slightly thrown off by the joy and happiness declaration, but their minds were surely back in sync with the message of doing and experiencing to create meaning. The third key to fulfillment would catch most off guard, but this particular audience was likely expecting it: suffering. The professor went on, "True suffering of an authentic fate is an achievement, and indeed is the highest possible achievement." No, the doctor, who was soon to have his PhD in philosophy, hadn't gone off the rails. To him, suffering wasn't to be sought out. But if we found ourselves there, meaning could be extracted. Suffering strips us of our vanities and allows us an opportunity to respond, to determine what our reaction would be to hardship and difficulty. To the man standing at the lectern, suffering wasn't just a way to develop meaning, but meaning was a way to get through suffering. To work through adversity, the suffering needed to be meaningful, and to the doctor, that was determined by the individual and only that individual, as he told his audience. This wasn't the first time the doctor had given this lecture. He'd done so once before. He wasn't wearing a suit and tie. He wasn't standing in a lecture hall in front of a captive audience. It was a far different place. He was with 280 others, split into rows of 5. They weren't dressed in the business attire of the current audience. They were a ragged group, smaller in size and girth. Before the lecture began, small talk centered on the same topic, the soup that would be fed for dinner. The lecture wasn't vocal, but in his mind. To distract from his current ordeal, to provide a brief escape for his mind, Viktor Frankl visualized being in the same lecture hall he was standing in now and began his lecture titled "The Psychology of the Concentration Camp." While few of us will face a challenge as horrifying as enduring a concentration camp, learning from those who went through unbelievable suffering provides lessons on navigating lesser problems. When the going gets tough, it's easy to lose meaning. When our job seems overwhelming, when we're on the brink of burnout, it's only natural to shrug our shoulders and ask, "What's the point?" What those like Frankl, including researchers of the latest science, tell us is that purpose is the glue that holds us together. allowing us to rise above even the most harrowing of situations. The will to continue. Willie is a 6-year-old mutt, a mixture of Australian cattle dog and shepherd, that my wife found living in a tire when he was only a few months old. He's also got quite the personality, equally intelligent and mischievous. In his spare time, Willie sticks to his world of contrasts, having 2 loves, watching TV and running. The former is an amusing but also annoying habit he's picked up of pressing his large black nose to whatever screen has movement and sound coming out of it. Turn on a video of horses, and your screen will be destroyed. The latter act, running, is a more normal activity for a dog. When Willie goes on a run, he makes it 5 miles in the chilly winter months, tugging at his leash the whole way. But whenever the heat and humidity of the summer come through, Willie's endurance evaporates. He trots through 2 miles with the same eagerness and excitement, but the heat quickly slows his pace from the usual 7-minute miles to a more pedestrian 9-minute mile pace. Willie runs the same 2-mile route every summer day. He knows the turns, taking them before we even signal to. He could pace it to perfection, but his pacing skills resemble the children discussed in Chapter 3. Out hard, slow in the middle, before a spurt to the finish when we round the corner to the house. But there's something else that will cause Willie to abandon the fatigue-induced trot for a full-bore sprint. Squirrels. His pink tongue could be fully hanging out of his mouth, signaling that he's nearly had enough. He could have slowed to a panting, filled walk. But in the throes of fatigue, it all changes once he catches a glimpse of that small gray animal that torments his life. He springs up and begins to put his 60-pound frame to work, pulling toward his mortal enemy. Willie found motivation, or dare I say meaning, to bring him back from the depths of despair. In Chapter 3, I discussed how children and adult endurance athletes typically decide to speed up or slow down. They use a heuristic, comparing actual versus expected effort for where they are at during the race. If they feel better than expected, they speed up. Worse? Time to slow down. But I intentionally left out one component: drive. Performance equals actual effort divided by expected effort times drive. Whether we call it drive, motivation, or purpose, the last component determines our bandwidth for how far into the depths of fatigue we can push. Contrary to common convention, when we are exhausted, we haven't completely depleted our reserves. Even the athlete who collapses to the ground after a race had more left in the tank. His or her muscles could still function. Just think, if our brain truly allowed us to go to zero, to empty, would that be smart or dangerous? Your body is trying to protect you, and it has a safety mechanism, an alarm that sounds to convince you to slow down, to stop, to make the pain and fatigue go away. But, according to the latest theories in exercise science, how close to zero we get is variable. We are like the car with the countdown of how many miles we can drive before we hit zero. For the adventurous among us, you quickly learned that this gauge isn't entirely accurate. You may be able to drive 10, 20, or even 30 miles past the point your car tells you that you have 0 miles to go. There's leeway between when the vehicle manufacturers programmed the display to tell you that you are empty and when your gas tank is indeed empty. It's a safety mechanism designed to prevent people from tempting fate, pushing their car too far, and running out of gas on the side of the road. Our body utilizes the same type of process, warning us, through the sensation of effort and fatigue, that we are at zero before we actually hit zero. There's always something in reserve. Drive determines how close to empty we can push before our body shuts us down, before it flips from voluntary shutdown to initiating near catastrophe. Our brain weighs that complicated gas mileage algorithm with how important the task is. Because we never truly reach zero in our body's energy reserves, that would mean catastrophic failure, we use the level of importance and the risk versus reward to determine how close to zero we can get. Is our life on the line? Is our child's life in jeopardy? Then we might be able to perform superhuman feats like lifting a car off a trapped child's body. Is it a regular season game, or is it game 7 of the finals? We might get a little extra juice in the latter case. According to the latest science of fatigue, your brain essentially tries to protect you from harming yourself, and it uses the perceived risks versus the potential rewards to fix where that governor is. Having a strong purpose acts as a turbo boost. Whether that purpose comes from God, family, playing for your teammates, or a mission that holds deep importance, when our pursuits match with our purpose, we persist for much longer. Research shows that purpose and persistence are linked in the classroom, workplace, and athletic fields. When we have a purpose, we are able not only to endure and persist, but also to provide a beacon that reminds us of what's important and to make the right decision at the right moment. Toughness maxim. Purpose is the fuel that allows you to be tough. From fear to despair to apathy. 11 months after being liberated, Viktor Frankl stood at the podium in a lecture hall in the outskirts of Vienna and delivered the talk he'd imagined while trapped in captivity. By 1946, he had published a book that changed psychotherapy, The Doctor and the Soul, and a book that the Library of Congress would dub as one of the 10 most influential books in the U.S., Man's Search for Meaning. The latter he wrote in 9 days. Each outlined the horrors of survival, but with an underlying current of hope. To go from concentration camp to producing works that are still relevant over a half century later is quite the feat. But as Frankl said, he'd been working on them for years. Frankl entered the Theresienstadt concentration camp in 1942 with a book manuscript sewn into his jacket pocket. Like all possessions, the jacket was confiscated, and with it the manuscript. Frankl had already developed his theory on meaning, and now he was unfortunately about to put it to the test. Over the next few years, Frankl experienced the unimaginable horror of living through the Holocaust. He lost his mother, father, and wife. Meaning willed him forward. Frankl took his psychotherapist training and applied it to observing the conditions of the camp and its inhabitants. He witnessed how everyone, including himself, went through a series of phases. First, there was shock of being stripped of all reminders of his former self, before momentarily looking for the quickest out. Everyone in this situation flirts, if only for a moment, with the idea of running into the wire, committing suicide, using the usual method in the camp: contact with the high-voltage barbed wire fence. As the tragedy and uncertainty grow, individuals transition to a state of apathy, where the horror of their reality becomes almost normalized. Individuals who once reacted to death and despair with a standard emotional response now felt nothing. As he remarked, whereas in the first few days, the sheer abundance of experiences filled with ugliness, hateful in every sense, provoke feelings of horror, outrage, and disgust, these feelings eventually subside, and inner life as a whole is reduced to a minimum. The common remark to the death of another in the camp became a somber, not because it didn't matter, but because the inner world fell into hibernation. Feelings and emotions disappeared, replaced by a kind of non-responsive protective state, and inner thoughts circled around the only thing that seemed to matter: food. In a study of other Holocaust survivors, researchers confirmed Frankl's experience, with 2 survivors named Lou and Esther reporting they felt numb and living a day at a time. Your brains don't work. First, you want to die. Then you want to survive. According to Frankl, survival depended on your inner world. Despite the cruelty visited on prisoners by the guards, the beatings, torture, and constant threat of death, there was one part of their lives that remained free: their own minds, Frankl reported in his book Yes to Life. The key to a free mind was seeing meaning in life, not just in the way we are used to thinking of it, as some greater purpose, but in every moment, that if we could find meaning in the minuscule portions of life, that something was greater than ourselves, then we would possess the will to survive, or, if circumstances deemed otherwise, the peace to see meaning in our demise. Freedom was the key to meaning, freedom to choose how you saw and experienced every part of suffering. To Frankl, death contained meaning, just as life did. Freedom of your mind wasn't just about surviving. It was about being able to choose. That if you were going to die, you still had the ability to escape the place you were in, to go somewhere else, even if it was only in your mind. That even in death, it was essential that we should die a death of our own, and not the death that the SS had forced on us. Frankl wrote that those who did not survive were not the weakest, but among the strongest. Finding meaning in your circumstance, in your suffering, or as a purpose to guide and ground you, was the key to handling such utter atrocity. For Frankl, that meaning was simple: to return to his loved ones and to finish his life's work. As he relays in his autobiography, "I am convinced that I owe my survival, among other things, to my resolve to reconstruct that lost manuscript. Writing gave him meaning, a will to survive. That's why during labor camp, his mind drifted to a future lecture. And when someone provided a pencil and scraps of paper in 1945, it gave him the needed boost to bounce back from a bout of despair." Frankl went into the Holocaust with ideas from his experience as a doctor. He came out experiencing death and despair and seeing firsthand how he and others coped with it. It led him to conclude, "The unshakable belief in an unconditional meaning to life, that, one way or another, makes life bearable. Because we have experienced the reality that human beings are truly prepared to starve, if starvation has a purpose or meaning." Much of the research in subsequent years confirms Frankl's experience. In a study on 89 Holocaust survivors, Katarzyna Prott-Klinger found that they consistently highlighted the importance of support and belonging, having someone to return to, preserving a sliver of normalcy, and perhaps most importantly, luck. In a study of 13 survivors, Roberta Green found similar themes, including making choices, practicing inner control, making a conscious decision to live, celebrating life, and thinking positively. When asked how they survived, people focused in their answers on family and making meaning of their circumstances and the war. In another study on Holocaust survivors, sociologist Aaron Antonovsky concluded that having a sense of coherence or a way to make sense of the world is what mattered. Coherence was made up of three components: comprehensibility, manageability, and meaningfulness. Meaning's impact extends beyond Holocaust survivors to sufferers of other traumas. While most of us are familiar with the debilitative phenomenon of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, the positive cousin, post-traumatic growth, PTG, is lesser known. In research involving those who've suffered traumatic experiences, from natural disasters to seeing the death of friends and family to experiencing the horrors of being a prisoner of war, a surprisingly large percentage of survivors experience PTG. You might think that it must be those who suffered a milder version of the trauma that were able to grow from it, but that's not the case. In a number of studies on former POWs from the Vietnam War, the longer a POW spent in captivity, the more physical injuries experienced, the higher the growth. With significant trauma, our worldview and the assumptions contained within them are shattered. Yet, this shattering of assumptions allows these individuals to make their way through misery and reach higher levels of personal strength and appreciation of life and what it brings. When their worlds are challenged, a search for meaning commences. In this search, they are able to reconstruct their inner narrative, acknowledging their personal strength in navigating catastrophe and redefining what matters in life. According to psychiatrist Adriana Feder and colleagues at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, Severe trauma triggers a search for meaning and a fundamental reconfiguration of a person's life goals. Individuals who experience post-traumatic growth don't avoid the discomfort. They experience the same flood of emotions and rumination of their internal voices that everyone else experiences. They are able to sort through and explore discomfort. Instead of intrusive rumination that causes them to spiral, they alter their inner voice, using what psychologists call deliberate and constructive rumination. Akin to the calm conversation discussed earlier, deliberate rumination meant an internal dialogue that's focused on problem solving, whereas self-talk was focused on reflecting on and dealing with the situation in a more controlled and non-judgmental way. To switch our inner world from intrusive to deliberate, we need to have a sense of control and an ability to understand and regulate our emotions. When studying over 170 college students who had experienced suffering due to the death of loved ones, debilitating accidents, or violence in their home, George Mason University psychologist Todd Kashtan found that it was those who navigated their anxiety and trauma not via avoidance but through exploration who experienced the highest levels of growth. When we explore instead of avoid, we are able to integrate the experience into our story. We're able to make meaning out of struggle, out of suffering. Meaning is the glue that holds our minds together, allowing us to both respond and recover. It stalls the jump from difficulty to complete despair, from fear and anxiety to full-blown freakout. As Viktor Frankl said so many years ago when discussing the plight of those in concentration camps, he retains a freedom, a human freedom, to adapt to his fate, his environment, in one way or another. And indeed, there was a one way or another. Meaning provides the freedom for us to choose. Toughness maxim. When we explore instead of avoid, we are able to integrate the experience into our story. We're able to make meaning out of struggle, out of suffering. Meaning is the glue that holds our minds together, allowing us to both respond and recover. The nuance of inner strength. Step on a crack, break your mother's back. When I was a child, I believed this. No, not in the way most children did, with a slight tinge of fear of this silly rhyme coming true, but in the literal sense. I was also afraid that if I didn't touch the fronts and backs of doorknobs, someone in my family would die, or that if I didn't complete my bedtime ritual of turning the alarm on and off 7 times before getting in my bed on the same side, in the same way, every night, I might not wake up the next morning. Ever since I can remember, I have suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. I didn't have a name for it. My blissfully unaware family called them quirks. I didn't understand what they were, but every one of those experiences and the danger that accompanied them felt entirely real. Growing up with OCD was bizarre, but also normal. When you're young, you don't realize what you're thinking and processing, or even whether it's wrong. Having intrusive thoughts was normal. Experiencing thoughts of harm and death slowly became part of life. It was irrational, and I grew to know that, but it felt so real. It isn't until you move on from the naivete of the early years, when your executive function starts to come fully online and awareness kicks in, that you start to ask, "What's wrong with me?" Asking that question as a teen was not easy. It was downright terrifying, coming to grips with the fact that others didn't have the same thoughts or fears I did. They didn't see harm every time they picked up a knife or were driving along the freeway. OCD was my burden, something that I had to navigate largely by myself. Don't get me wrong, my parents were supportive, helpful whenever I literally thought I was going to die if I went to sleep. But they were naive. A Southern conservative family in the 1990s who had no awareness of mental health and still thought seeing a shrink was a sign of weakness or a label that would follow you for the rest of your life. In their minds, they were trying to protect me, get through childhood without any long-lasting labels, be normal, and all would work out. They taught me avoidance. Push the bad thoughts away. Stay away from activities that trigger you. So as a child, navigating the inner world of intrusive thoughts was almost all on me. While there are many different variations of OCD, the popular press gets the portrayal wrong. We see the compulsions, the obsessive cleaning, the rituals, and think that is the disorder. That's the end result. OCD is a condition of intrusive thoughts mixed with a strong feeling and sensation that pushes us toward the compulsion. We complete the ritual as an act of soothing or coping with the thoughts and feelings. The key to fixing my obsessive need to touch the front and back of every doorknob wasn't to tell or train me to stop doing that. It was to disentangle the thought and feeling that nudged and sometimes shoved me toward that action. In one form of OCD, thoughts and action become deeply intertwined. There's no space between them. This so-called thought-action fusion occurs when a person feels that merely thinking a terrible thought either can make it come true or is just as bad as if you went through with it. As we learned in Chapter 7, intrusive thoughts occur fairly regularly in all of us. The difference is that in those who suffer from OCD, the intensity dial is turned up to 11. Sufferers genuinely believe that the momentary thought of turning their car into oncoming traffic or jumping off the balcony of their apartment means that they are actually going to do it. For most of us, that random message in our brain is brushed off, a misfire that we don't need to assign any meaning to. For OCD sufferers, it's real. The feeling of fear comes with it, and a behavior to cope soon follows. It's not just the intertwining of thoughts and action that is the issue. Recent research shows that the brains of those who suffer from OCD have a hard time learning what's safe and what's not. Once something has been deemed threatening, it's as if it's carved in stone, while for the rest of the population, it's written in pencil. Researchers found that when they associated a green face with an electric shock, both OCD patients and a control group responded as if the face was a threat. However, when they took the shock away and showed the green face repeatedly, the control group quickly came to understand that it meant no danger here. The OCD group couldn't let go of the lingering threat. The area in their brain related to processing safety signals, the prefrontal cortex, wasn't firing. Now, think about what we've learned in relation to toughness. Thoughts and feelings interact, building upon each other, pushing us toward action. Our threat detection center plays a large role, biasing us toward fight, flight, freeze, or whatever we might think is best. Notice the similarities? OCD sufferers have to deal with every element of our pattern of toughness, only with the system rigged against us. A deeply connected thought, feeling, urge pattern that misfires and misdirects. Growing up, we saw OCD as a sort of defect, something we had to hide or overcome. Ignore it. Don't discuss it. It was something that signified that I was different, or that there was something wrong with me. But as I've grown older, I've come to understand OCD as something different. It was reality, part of who I was, something that I had to learn to accept and navigate. Fortunately, I suffer from a moderate version, and am in no way discounting those who suffer from a more severe version. I was lucky enough to figure out ways to cope, not by fighting or suppressing, but by gradually creating space between thought and action. Just enough where I could squeeze in a different way to cope instead of following through with a compulsion. I learned how to separate the thought from the feeling and urge, rewiring my mind to recognize that a thought is a thought, and some are meaningless. I still suffer from OCD, the intrusive thoughts and behavioral urges. It will always be part of who I am, but it taught me something, that those who society sees as weak often are the strongest on the inside. While much of this book focuses on developing toughness in the individual and team, the greater issue is how we conceptualize toughness as a society. We prop up the brazen and boisterous, providing a platform for those who scream the loudest. We promote those who are brash and overconfident, even though their work and results don't merit the bravado. We support politicians who write books with titles promoting admirable values such as resilience, fortitude, healing during division, truth, and self-reliance. Yet when it comes to acting in accordance with those proposed notions, our political elite ditch those oh-so-esteemed values, and then drive back and forth over them as long as they get their payday or accolades. We prop up the companies that create slick-looking ads promoting values of inclusion and diversity, all while the inner workings of those companies are littered with cultures of abuse, hostility, and harassment. We've fallen for the appearance without the substance. We've chosen the glitzy Instagram filter version of toughness, one that is staged, distorted, and dependent on choosing to live in a fantasy instead of embracing reality, acknowledging the struggles, the failure, the doubts, the insecurity. Real toughness is coming to terms with who we are and what we face, and making sense of and finding meaning in that struggle. It's time to leave the old-school notion of toughness behind. The external and fake version might give us the momentary feeling of strength and power when we lead via fear and control. But it's temporary. It quickly fades away. And as I've shown over and over again, when it really matters, it fails. We've copied the early 20th century football coach and drill sergeant model for far too long. We know where it leads. To something that looks like toughness on the outside, but upon closer inspection falls apart. It's time to turn away from a false idol and hold up a different kind of toughness. Society desperately needs us to emphasize the internal, not the external. Real toughness is living in the nuance and complexity of the environment, bodies, and minds we inhabit. There is no one standard pathway to inner strength. No formula for making difficult decisions or dealing with the extremes of discomfort. Real toughness is about acceptance of who you are, what you're going through, and the discomfort that often comes with it. It's living in that place of tension so that the needed space can be created to find the best path forward. It's time to embrace a better, real kind of toughness, one that acknowledges our common humanity and slays the myth that old-school toughness promotes. My hope is that this book is a small step toward a major course correction, one that teaches our children that acting tough isn't the same thing as being tough, that being vulnerable and honest isn't a sign of weakness, but a sign of strength. It's time to redefine toughness. It's more important now than ever before. Ditch the facade and the external. It's time to focus on true inner strength. We're all capable of developing such inner strength, even those who might be labeled as weak or failures. Here's to embracing reality, being secure in who we are, embracing our feelings and emotions as information, fulfilling our basic human needs, and finding purpose and meaning in life to carry us through life's challenges. As biographer Joshua Wolf Schenck wrote about the man who had to figure out how to help the country he loved navigate its toughest period, Lincoln, by whatever combination of habit and choice, took his own path. He did not pretend to be anything other than he was. Be who you are. That's real toughness.